When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, the bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. I'm Vas Krisadoulou. How can you fight the experience of being jaded and learn to see the world through fresh eyes? That's the question answered in a new book by neuroscientist Tali Sharrat and legal scholar Cass Sunstein. It's called Look Again. Tali joined us online a couple of weeks back to share more with David Malone.
The sort of the absolute epicenter of the book is this word, habituation. Why is it that I've never really thought about it?
Yeah, so maybe just it's a good idea to start by defining what it is. So habituation is our tendency to respond less and less and less to things that are constant or that change very slowly. So an easy example is you walk into a room full of cigarette smoke. At first, the smoke is quite overwhelming, right? You really smell it, it's salient. But studies show that within 20 minutes, you can't perceive the smoke any longer. Similarly, you might jump into a pool, it's really cold, but not many minutes go by and it doesn't feel so cold anymore. There's an AC in the background, but you can't really notice it, you can't hear it. So these are kind of the physiological, like sensory type of stimuli that we don't notice because they've been there for a while. They haven't changed. And the book touches on these things, but they also touch on just how we respond to the good and bad things in our life. That's always been there, but we stop noticing them after a while. So it could be that we have a comfortable home or a loving relationship or maybe an interesting job. But all of these things have been there for a while. And what's interesting is they seem to not have as much impact on our daily happiness as you'd expect them to, because you've habituated, right? Similarly, there might be some really bad things in society or even not great things in your life. So it might be racism, sexism, cracks in our personal relationships, inefficiencies at the workplace. And over time, we just get used to them. So we stop noticing them and we stop reacting to them. On one hand, it's good to not have to feel so bad, right, about these things that are not great in our life. That's good. But on the other hand, if we don't react, if we don't feel, if we don't respond, then we don't try to change. And that's part of the problem.
I mean, it's the fact that we don't notice, it's not a failing. It's not that we're all falling down on the job. I mean, is this something that we're wired to do? And if we are, is there a good reason for it?
Yeah. So habituation is something that is really fundamental to how we're set up, right? To every neuron in our brain. Let's take the kind of smoke example. So you go into the room, your neurons fire, telling other neurons, oh, there's a smell of smoke here, right? Maybe it tells the motor neuron, maybe we should leave. But after a while, the neurons, olfactory neurons, will just quiet down. They're done. They convey the message. And that's really every part of our brain is set up like that, and not just a human brain. Every other creature has habituation too, right? It could be a fly or a dog or a rat. You can see habituation everywhere. And when you can see habituation everywhere, and it's so fundamental, that says there's probably an adaptive function to it. And there's a few adaptive functions. So one is just pure survival, right? Because by the fact that we stop responding to things that are just constant around us, that means we have the resources to respond to the new things that are coming our way, right? That may kill us, that we should respond to fast. So that's the survival mechanism. Now, thinking about kind of more high level in terms of humans and not just humans, their habituation also enhances our motivation. So if you think back to your first entry level job, you probably were quite excited and happy about this entry level job. But imagine what would happen if you continue being as excited and as happy about the entry level job for 10 years. You wouldn't be driven to go for that next job, right? For the next promotion. So what habituation does to the good stuff, it keeps us motivated. And also, there's so many studies showing that problems in habituation are related to a whole host of mental health conditions. I'll just give you one quick example. So people who tend to habituate slower to bad things, they tend to have depression, or maybe even to saying it the other way around. People with depression tend to habituate much slower to negative events in their life.
Hang on. So that means that they are continuing to notice the background stuff.
Well, it's not a background. It's something, if something bad happens to us, it could be background too, but the studies have been done on something bad that happens to you. So it might be, you know, loss of a loved one, and it could be something smaller, like getting a bad grade. So there's a study by Professor Aaron Heller at the University of Miami, where he had students who just got the result of a really important exam. He asked them how they were feeling. And then he continued asking them how they were feeling every 45 minutes for the rest of the day. And what he found is that when people got a bad grade, they felt bad. And it didn't matter if they had a history of depression or didn't have a history of depression. If you got a bad grade, everyone was feeling bad to the same extent. So it's not the people with depression were feeling worse. They were feeling the same. The difference was how fast did they bounce back, right? So people with depression, they continue to ruminate over this bad, the grade, right? The bad grade that they got. And they weren't able to let go and move on with their lives, right, in the next few hours. But people with no depression history, just healthy individuals in this kind of term, it took a while, but not as long. And, you know, it didn't take that long for them to bounce back and get on with their life and continue. So that's, you know, and it's been shown also for example, with COVID, it's also been shown that during COVID, people actually kind of bounced back and adapted. This is beyond habituation, just adapting to difficult and negative experiences. People adapted quite fast, actually, to COVID, to being, you know, stuck at home and having to maybe change your immediate environment so that it's easier for you to live in this small space with maybe children and so on. But people with mental health conditions and mental health history, they actually had a much more difficult time. They weren't as, it wasn't as easy for them to adapt. And these kind of like triggers, you know, maybe hearing about the outcomes of COVID and things like that had much more of a negative effect for them again and again and again. On one hand, you might say, well, that's good because we need to fight, right? On the other hand, it's difficult because you can't go on with your life.
Okay, got you. So is there an upside of, I mean, how fast or slow people habituate? I mean, in other words, someone who habituates quickly, that means that they get used to the new state of affairs. Have I got that the right way around? I just want to make sure that.
Right. So there's not, you know, you could habituate quickly to bad stuff, but not to good stuff. You can habituate quickly to like some sensory, like maybe auditory, but not like visual. I mean, perhaps you can probably measure a general tendency to habituate. But what we just discussed now is how fast you habituate to the bad stuff, right? And so for depression specifically, is people habituate slower to negative events. And more generally, there's all sorts of mental health conditions that are associated with problems in habituation in different ways. So first example in schizophrenia is actually slow habituation to sensory stimuli, like noise and things like that. However, if you think about that, well, people who can't habituate, that's bad because that's related to mental health conditions. On the other hand, at the same time, it's also been shown that people who habituate slowly actually tend to be more creative. So you could measure, for example, how you habituate, let's say, to a sound. So if you hear the same sound again and again and again and again, after a while, you'll stop noticing it. And you can measure that physiologically. Like, for example, skin conductance, how you sweat in response to sounds. And so you can measure that. And what's been found is that people who are especially creative, for example, perhaps they have a patent under their name, perhaps they have an exhibition, they have an art exhibition or book that they wrote, it's been shown that these people actually habituate slower. And so there's a question, why is that? Why is there this relationship between creativity and slow habituation? And I think potentially part of the answer is that when you habituate slower, there's more bits of information kind of staying around in your mind, kind of sounds and images and pieces of information. They kind of stay around in your brain, your mind, and it could be very distracting, right? But on the other hand, because there's this mishmash, the soup of like little bits of information that you got from different places in your mind, that means that they kind of collide once in a while and create this new idea, right? Or something creative. Bits of information from different domains. It might be like mundane bits of knowledge from one domain, and another bit of information could be very mundane for another domain that comes together. And then suddenly when it comes together, there's a solution to a problem that you were thinking of, right? It's actually very common to have creative solutions in one domain coming from another domain. Like, for example, a solution in technology coming from actually biology, right? So that it potentially is why people who habituate slower tend to be more creative.
Hmm. That links up to the subtitle then, of the power of noticing what was always there. I mean, in a sense, then, are you saying right. that to take the cliche of the artist, you know, I might walk outside and I'm sort of, there's a sea right at the end of my street and some trees and, but I imagine lots of days I wouldn't really take much notice because I expect it to be there and I see it every day. Whereas maybe the cliche of the artist is that they're always attuned to what's there. They actually notice it. They see it for what it actually is, whereas I'm just sort of glossing over it. Is that that's what you mean?
Yes, it could be the noticing itself, but it also could be just that these kind of pieces of images and sounds and information, they are just in your mind for longer. And so now you've seen that, you know, whatever it was, what do you say, the ocean or something. And then you're thinking about something completely different. You're trying to solve like a physics problem, right? And so these things, they seem unrelated, but now perhaps what you saw in the waves in the ocean helps you solve a physics problem, right? For example, we take one example that we have in the book is Dick Fosbury, who invented the Fosbury flop, right? So he's a high jumper. He was a high jumper. And until his time, people used to do the jump facing forward, right? Now, if you look at the, you know, people jumping high jumps, they jump backwards, right? But that's something that he invented. And one of the reasons that he was able to come up with a solution is because not only was he a jumper, but he was also an engineer student, right? So he had this knowledge of engineering and, you know, and at the same time, he was also trying to get better, in this case, jumping, right? And so that may have created this kind of combination that led to creativity, that led to innovation. So that suggests that perhaps if we want to enhance creativity, one thing that we want to try to do is dishabituate. Right. To try to actually be more able to take in information or right from different domains and things like that. And there's a study showing that even small changes that you can make to your environment can enhance your likelihood of dishabituating and therefore the likelihood of creativity. So, for example, in one study that was conducted by Kelly Main, she found that if people simply move from one room to another, they are working in the office, then they go work in a coffee shop. They work in the office, they go for a walk, and they come back. What she found is that just changing your environment actually enhances creativity. So the people were more likely to come up with creative solutions that she gave them when they changed environments. Now, that being said, creativity boost only lasted for 6 minutes every time they made a change. So it wasn't a long-term thing. However, those 6 minutes can actually be quite important, right? That could be the time when you come up with that new idea, when you come up with that new solution. And I think when people maybe think about some ideas that were important for their, you know, professional career, you may often, at least it is true in my case, when I think about those times, and I can remember them. I don't know if that's the case for other people. I think probably yes. I can remember those times when I was able to solve a problem, then that would lead to years of research, or to come up with the idea that would then lead to things that I would do for a very, very, very long time. And every one of these incidents is not a time when I was sitting in front of my computer trying to come up with an idea, or sitting in front of a computer trying to solve a problem. In fact, it was when I left the computer and I did something else. So one example is I was trying to solve a very specific problem, and I couldn't solve it. So I left my office and I went to the gym. And so I was walking to the gym. I don't necessarily think I was consciously thinking about this problem, but before I even reached the gym, which was probably within the 6 minutes that Kaylee Main observed, the solution came. And that solution then led to years of things that were done afterwards. Another example is I was at a conference listening to talk. So I got a lot of information, right? A lot of information coming into my mind. But then at the end of the conference was in San Francisco. I was like traveling in Napa, walking around wineries and sitting and having a glass of wine. And it was then when I came up with this idea that was based on things that I was listening to before, but not necessarily consciously thinking of until, you know, I was in this very different scenario, right? Looking at the lovely views and having a glass of wine. So I think there is definitely something that seems true about her research and what she found in her experiments.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Marquee TV. Marquee TV is an incredible streaming service that is a gateway to arts and culture. With my subscription, I've enjoyed watching some of the Royal Shakespeare Company's most acclaimed productions of recent years, including David Tennant in Richard II and Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest. I've seen multiple productions of The Ring Cycle and Thelonious Monk playing in Brussels in 1963. I've watched Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Opera House and Giselle at La Scala. Marquee TV really is the most accessible way into culture I've ever encountered, and a treasure trove for any arts lover. You can try it for 3 months for just 99p. Yep, 3 months for 99p with the code HOWTO. Just visit marquee.tv and use the promo code HOWTO to dive into the world of the arts like never before.
I mean, does that suggest that we look again at how maybe we sometimes structure learning for kids rather than make them do, you know, a double period of biology where they just have to sit there and concentrate, that maybe it wouldn't be such a bad idea of every 15 minutes allowing the kids to get up and do something, or not just chain them to their seats, or is it not really that simple?
Right. I mean, I think you have to have a balance, and that's true for everything that we're going to talk about. You do need time to concentrate, right? And to take in whatever information you're taking in, and at the same time, you then need a change. So I don't know. I can't give you like a formula, and probably there isn't one, because I mean, we would love to have a solution like that, but you know, even I gave you a number of 6 minutes, but that's just on average, right? Those 6 minutes are not like for every person, those 6 minutes, right? It's just for all her subjects together, right? She looked and she saw on average, they came with a solution within 6 minutes, but you know, I'm sure there are people whose it didn't help at all. And people who had the gain, the boost in creativity last for a whole hour. And probably it's not only about individual differences. It's probably like what exactly, where they were, what kind of change did they make, what they were thinking of, what was the problem. So I think it is something that we want to consider. You know, I think you're right. It is something that we may want to consider in the educational system. Is there enough variety? Maybe there is. You know, it's something to look at. Maybe there's already enough variety, but is there enough variety? But at the same time, we don't want to be all over the place, right? Jumping from one thing to another.
The whole thing is making me feel a lot better about when I get up and think, oh, I'm just going to make myself a cup of tea. And yeah, like you, I do have the experience of thinking about often I'm off to do something like make myself a cup of tea. And then the thing that I've been trying to solve, you go, ah, oh yeah. And you hurry back to your desk because there it is. There is something perverse about the fact that you concentrate for an hour and then the answer comes when you nip out of the room to make a cup of tea. But let's talk about some of the, I mean, you spend the first part of the book talking about what habituation is and dishabituation and but then you then in the second half of the book, I suppose, you start looking at the role of this in lots of very relevant social things. You know, you talk about let's start with one of the first ones that you talk about, social media, and it's tied up with misinformation. So just unpick for us how those things which people talk about all the time, the role of misinformation and social media, where habituation and dishabituation, how they give you a handle on that.
Mm-hmm. So we have one chapter about misinformation, and a lot of misinformation is online and on social media. And we have another one about social media. So maybe start with misinformation. So it's basically the relationship between habituation and misinformation is related to the fact that when you hear a statement more than once, you're more likely to believe it. The effect is so strong. We do experiments all the time in our lab. And this is the type of effect that you always like get a strong effect. You show people a few statements once, versus you show them another group of statements twice. The ones that you show them twice, they're more likely to believe. And also we find that they are then more willing to share it on social media. Things that they listened to, they heard twice, they believe more, and they then want to share it on social media more, because at the end of the day, most people want to share accurate, true information. So if they hear things more than once, they think it's accurate and they're like, well, now I want to share it with my friends, with my followers, and so on. And okay, so why is it that when you hear something more than once, you're more likely to believe it? The reason is that when you hear something more than once, your brain processes it less because it's already been processed. For example, if I tell you a shrimp's heart is in its head, the first time I tell you this, there's a lot of processing going on. You might think about the last time that you ate a shrimp. You might imagine the shrimp and the heart is in its head, right? Your brain will kind of like, there's a huge surprise signal, and then it will process it in different ways. Imagery, you know, language, text, and so on. But the second time when I tell you a shrimp's heart is in its head, much less processing is going on. Your brain's already done the processing, so it doesn't respond. There is no surprise signal, or maybe a very much smaller one. And you don't take the effort and time to kind of try to like think about it, right? To assess this kind of statement. And all of this is unconscious, right? We're not really aware that we're doing that. And when we hear something that there's no surprise signal, it doesn't require processing, it just kind of, we accept it immediately. And that makes us think that it's probably true. Because usually the things that we hear more than once are usually true. The things that we don't need to process, the things that don't have a surprise signal, are ones that are most often true. And so, we call this like, familiar true fear. So things that are kind of more familiar, like our heuristic is, oh, they're probably true fear. They're more likely to be true. And so that's why it's called the illusory truth effect. And it's basically this phenomena by which you hear something more than once, you're more likely to believe it. Now, on social media, this happens a lot, right? You're very much likely to see the same statement, the same headline more than once, because people share, right? So you'd have your people that you're following will share the same stuff. So you'll see not even twice, you'll see them again and again and again. And then you will be likely to believe it, which, you know, makes sense. It's not something that seems irrational. But unfortunately, that's a way to spread misinformation. So on one hand, it's good to know, because if you are trying to convince people of things which are true, then, you know, it's important for you to remember, repeat, repeat, repeat. However, it's also true that if people are trying to spread misinformation, this is an easy way to do it. They show it more than once, people believe it, and then they start sharing it themselves because they think it's true. So that's one way in which habituation comes into misinformation. And again, the habituation, just simply by the definition of, we respond less to things that are repeated, to things that are constantly there. Now, like, looking at a totally different aspect of why we talk about social media and habituation is that we think about social media as a prime example of something that can be suboptimal in your life, but you don't notice how so or to what extent because it's always there. So I think most people, not everyone, but I think most people would suspect that social media is probably causing them a little bit of anxiety, a little bit of stress, right? It might make you a little bit unhappy, but it's always there. So you can't really identify if this is true or to what extent. It's a bit like an AC in the background, right? It's always buzzing and you don't really notice it's interfering with your daily life until someone turns it off and you're like, whew, now I feel so much better. And I didn't even realize that I was bothered by this sound, right? Or a TV in the background when people shut it off. And I think it's the same with social media. You don't really notice until you shut it down. And then you can really assess to what degree is this affecting you, if at all, and then make an informed decision of what to do. There is a study by the economist Hans Alcott, where he had two groups of people, 1,000 individuals, where he gave them $100 each to go off social media for a month. In fact, it was on Facebook. It's quite an old study. So they went off Facebook for a month. And the other group of people, 1,000 individuals, he paid them $100 each to just continue as usual. No change. And then he came back at the end of the month to see what happened. And what he found is, on every single dimension, those individuals who went off Facebook were doing better. They were feeling better. They were happier. They were meeting more people in real life, playing the piano, reading books. It was quite clear. And what was interesting is, not only were they doing better, they were surprised to what extent. Most people said, I didn't expect it to have such a big effect on me, right? And they didn't know it until they shut it down. And perhaps even more surprising than this is that, despite the fact that most people said, I feel better now, I'm happier overall, most people at the end of the month just went straight back to Facebook.
How do you explain that then?
There's a question of how, why is that happening? We think it's probably one of two things, probably both. One is, you can get information from Facebook that is useful to you. It doesn't necessarily make you happy. So it doesn't enhance your well-being, but you know what's going on, right? Maybe you know more about what's going on in the world, about your family and so on. So I think a lot of decisions that we make, and I mean, this is interesting that we can talk about what's important to people, are not necessarily about enhancing our well-being or happiness. There are other things that matter. That's one option. The other option, which is not, both things can be true at the same time, it looks a little bit like addiction. Addiction is a situation where we approach things that we don't even like anymore. We know that they are not causing us even pleasure, but we have this drive to continue and engage, right? In neuroscience, we talk about this distinction between liking and wanting. Liking is a pleasure that you feel when you interact with something. It could be a cigarette, it could be alcohol, it could be chocolate, it could be whatever, it could be a person. Wanting is, you are kind of feel an obsession, like a need to interact with this, engage. And the two things are not necessarily, a lot of times, they're very correlated. You like what you want and you want what you like. The two things go together. But with addiction, sometimes they're separated, where you don't like anymore. You don't get the pleasure, but you have the drive, right? There's been like kind of like a problem in the system. And that may be a little bit what's going on with social media. And in fact, there is data to support this, because there's a study showing that people say that they are willing to pay to have social media not exist. And yet they're on social media, right? So they would want it not to exist, and they're willing to pay money for it. The other kind of characteristics of addiction is that the more you do it, the more you do it. So the more you engage with this thing, the more like you're engaged with it again. And you can see this with social media, that when people are on, when they're off, they feel the need to go back on, right? And the more they go on, the more the need is enhanced. And so they go on again and again and again, log on again and again and again.
Let's then move on to, I suppose they're two related. You talk about our ability to habituate to lies. And then I think it's the very next chapter you talk about what you call, it's a wonderful phrase, ethical erosion. So tell us a bit about those, because they're the sort of the, I mean, I was going to say the dark side, although what we just talked about wasn't exactly cheerful and full of light, but these
yeah,
are sort
of the lighter side later.
Yeah, these are the sort of the weaknesses that come with habituation.
Yeah. So really, the whole book began because of a study that we I conducted in the lab with my colleagues in 2016, where we found that people habituate to their own dishonesty. We had a kind of a setting where people had an opportunity to lie in order to have financial gain at the expense of another person. And we never said you should lie. We never said the word, but they could figure it out. And what we found was, interestingly, they started off by lying by just a little bit, just a few cents. And then the next time they lied more and more and more. So cents became lying by dollars and more, greater and greater and greater. So in fact, it was pounds because it was conducted in London. And so basically what that shows is that lying kind of snowballed, right? Dishonesty became larger and larger and larger. While they were doing this, we also recorded their brain activity in a brain imaging scanner. And what we found was at the beginning when they lied, even though they lied by just a little amount, there was strong activity in a part of the brain called the amygdala, which is important for emotional arousal. It's about the size of a cherry tomato, and you have one on each side of your brain. So at the beginning, they lied by a little bit, but there was a strong emotion response, right? They probably felt quite bad about it. But because of what's known as emotional habituation, which is your emotional reaction to anything, including your own behavior, your own dishonesty behavior, goes down over time, they felt less and less and less bad over time. And so there was nothing that was curbing their dishonesty. And so as the amygdala activity diminished, the dishonesty increased. And in fact, we could predict by how much more they would lie the next time by looking at how much the amygdala diminished on the trial before. And that study was published a few months before the presidential election of 2016, when it was Trump versus Clinton. So it got a lot of media response because everyone was interested in like dishonesty and dishonesty escalation and all of that. It was quite a lot of a huge response to that. But that kind of eventually triggered this idea that, as you said, habituation is something that is permanent in so many parts of our life, but people are not aware of it. And so when you kind of like, you know, you show the science, you show the experiment, people are interested. So we have it in dishonesty, but then it relates to risk taking. For example, we have a whole chapter about risk escalation. It relates to social media, it relates to misinformation, it relates to just to love and joy and all the other things as well.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And a very interesting point in the book, and I think it came up where you were talking about getting to believe things that might not be true. But it sort of resonates throughout all of the later chapters, which you were at pains to say, this isn't something, you know, I think you said in the book, you might be tempted to think that very rational, very well-educated, very clever people, they wouldn't be liable to this. It would only be the stupid people. And you were at great pains to say that all of your results and all the people who you quote found that everyone is susceptible to this. It's not a function of being clever or not so clever, that it's somehow it's just being human.
Yes, it's a fundamental feature of how our brain is set up and how it works. And that is true for a lot of things that I study. You know, a lot of the things that I study in my lab are just basic kind of phenomena, which is true for everyone and not only for every human, for most animals as well.
Oh, that's
just extremely basic. And as is habituation,
In the book, you talk about that everyone's susceptible to this when it came to mistaking familiar things that you heard and thinking they were true. But I wondered, was this universality also true for ethical erosion or for these other things? Or was it only in whether people would mistake a familiar lie for the truth? Was it true for all these other things as well?
Yeah. So, for example, it's also been shown that people are more likely to accept dishonesty and immoral behavior of other people and of people like their organization, countries, and so on, government, if they start small and then become larger and larger and larger, because we kind of habituate, we adapt, and sometimes we don't even see it, right? If you start off with a really like extraordinary immoral act at the beginning, that would probably get you a large reaction. But that doesn't often happen. Sometimes it does, but that doesn't often. Usually, whether it's within a company or within a country or a government, it usually starts small and then it becomes larger and larger and larger and larger, right? An incident, a few rule, and then people become comfortable with that. And then it's like a larger thing, right? And over time, you don't see it anymore at all, or less likely to, right? You could still react, but I think one of the point is that you will react less because of this. So even if you have a reaction, it probably will be smaller if the whole thing happened step by step by step by step, right? A, B, C, D, rather than straight going into D.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, if you, as you just said, that I could get used to my own lies or my own dishonesty, you know, with the experiment about telling lies and starting with a small lie. I mean, if I can get used to something which I can't deny, which is I'm telling a lie here. And if you're saying I would know I'm telling a lie, but even then I'll graduate to larger and larger lies. If that's how I'm made, then, and I can fool myself about my own behavior, then yes. I mean, how likely would it be that I would not be able to not make the same mistake when it came to other people's lies or my government's lies? Or I suppose that advertising relies on this, doesn't it? It relies on all of these tricks that they tell me something that's probably not true, but they tell me often enough that I go, well maybe Daz does clean whiter.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, whether it's marketers or politicians, I think they're well aware of some of these psychological phenomena, right? Which is repetition means people are more likely to believe. They're also more likely to remember. Makes sense, right? So if you hear the same slogan again and again and again, you're more likely to remember and therefore more likely to perhaps buy the product.
Yeah. There was one place in the book which it was on this topic of how, I think it was with lying, where it might have been the political aspect of other people telling us lies, where you sort of came out, you and your co-author, and said, so really what we need to do is nip these things in the bud. You can't say to yourself, it's just a little lie, so I won't worry about it. Because what you seem to suggest in the book is, yeah, fine, it'll be a little lie today and a whopper of a lie 6 months from now, either in your own behavior or others. So there was this third moment in the book which made me chuckle, because I suddenly saw you in this sort of puritanical garb saying, like a New England Puritan saying, no, we're absolutely not going to have any of that at all. Is that genuinely what you think? Or did you find yourself being backed into that conclusion because of everything you'd written? Because it is the conclusion of what you wrote.
Yeah, I know. I do think that is true. And we do have some caveats that we talk about in the chapter. I do think that is true. And I do try to do that, you know, with my children or like people, you know, members of my lab, where when there's small lies, you could just ignore them, right? Because I mean, there's no harm because there isn't. But I think it is better to call them out. You know, it's not like you have to like huge punishment or something. Be like, oh no, we can't do, you know, you shouldn't say that, or, you know, whether it's with your kids. I think that is important. And same thing with like, you know, people who work with you. There was incidents, and I remember two incidents. One is when I did call it out, right? There was a small incident and I did call that out you know, and this is like a what we call an N of one. You're like, yeah, you can't take conclusions, but let's take that one story, right? But when someone did something that was relatively small, I could definitely ignore it, but I decided not to. And that was good because I think that, you know, that it didn't happen again. While there was another incident where someone also started with some small lies, perhaps, you know, their CV was not quite accurate, and I decided to ignore it. And it just continued and continued, became bigger and bigger and bigger, so much so that it ended up badly. So I do think this is good advice. On the other hand, we need lies in our life, right? I mean, so we talk about this movie, The Invention of Lying, with Ricky Gervais. And the movie's not like so great, but the idea is quite interesting. It's about a world where no one knows what lie is. It's like everyone always says the truth, right? And they don't even realize what a lie is or what a truth is, because none, it doesn't exist, right? And you can see how this is not an easy world to live in, obviously, right? There's like a lot of times we engage in white lies. And in fact, our studies show that if you're lying for the benefit of another person, it doesn't escalate because you don't really feel as bad or at all negative. In fact, sometimes you can feel good, right? So in fact, it's not about just lying per se. It's the intention behind it, right? What the goal is. And you know, I have an example of my own life where now it's not quite, but when my kids were young, my younger son, he was always needed a lot of sleep, and he wanted and so he was happy to go to sleep early, and once we put him to bed, he fell asleep very fast. My older daughter didn't need so much sleep, but my younger son would not go to bed until my older daughter did, because he didn't want to miss anything, right? So what we ended up doing is pretending that she's going to sleep. So this is a lie, and it's not great. You know, it was me lying, my daughter lying, everyone lying to my
the moral rot
son.
Had set in early.
But you know, I did worry about it, about, like, you know, is this a norm, right? I'm like telling her, oh, it's okay to lie, right? You know, but there are a lot of situations where there's benefits, and you know, and so you need to consider those. But there's also a lot of cases where, you know, it's just better to call it out. I mean, in most cases,
I think you should only be worried if your daughter turns into a politician later in life. Then you might think to yourself, uh-oh.
Yeah, the likelihood is very low for that.
But I think you're right about small lies. I mean, if we didn't lie, then every time someone showed you a picture of their baby, we'd go, "Oof, that one's really ugly." And that wouldn't make you any friends. So, yeah. Ethical erosion. Let's talk about that, because that led you on to talking about how tyranny can get a hold. So there were quite ethically meaty chapters, which again is quite, it's interesting that you get to that from this seemingly single innocent term, habituation. And suddenly there we were in the Third Reich. Well, not suddenly. We got there eventually.
Yeah. But I mean, it's not, I mean, everything that we said is very much related to what we say in that chapter, right? We take in that chapter, we just take examples of what people said who were there, whether it was the German citizens who were there, and they were describing how it felt to them, right? This kind of very, very, very gradual events that took place, that perhaps if it wasn't gradual, then it wouldn't necessarily have, you know, it would be more likely to have a response from individuals. And so there's one person, I can try to find the quote, but it was something like, he was saying, and he was describing how it was to be in Nazi Germany as a German citizen, and he was describing how things just grew and grew and grew, and it felt like being in a field of corn where it grows so slowly that you don't notice, and then one day, you know, it is higher than you are. It's kind of looking at your children every day. You don't notice that they're growing because every day is just by a little bit. And I think it is a relatively good description of what happened in Germany in World War II, and it's probably a good description of other places and other incidents around the world, because a lot of times when we look back, it's hard to to understand how could that happen. It's so incredibly horrible, right? I mean, how is it that it was allowed to happen? And when you're in it, because it happens very, very gradually, you see it differently, or more likely you don't see it, right? It's very different than now looking back. I'm not saying that there is an excuse of any sort, but I think by trying to understand why things happen, it is helpful for trying to prevent similar things in the future. And one example is a study that we quote by Milgram. This is a very famous example. I'm sure everyone's, or most, a lot of people heard about this example. Milgram, his experiment, which is, you know, in the 60s, so it was a long time ago, he did this experiment exactly to try to understand this question, not of habituation. He tried to understand, how is it that this could have happened, right, in Nazi Germany? And what he was interested in studying was authoritism, like how the idea that he had is that when people are in an authority position, other people tend to follow, right? Because you tell them what to do and they would do, and they just, the instinct is, well, we're going to follow people with power. So his study tried to look at that. And it's a very well-known study. What he had people come in, sit in a room, and they were told that they were working with this other person, another individual who's also a volunteer in the experiment. The other volunteer was sitting in another room, and they were told, okay, we're going to pretend that you're the teacher and the other person is a student. As a teacher, you're going to ask, the student is going to get lots of pairs of words to remember, and you're going to say the first word, and they're going to have to repeat the second. So let's say it is like peanut computer. So if you say peanut, they have to say computer. Okay. So the important thing is that the other person was strapped with to electrodes that could give them shocks. And the teacher was supposed to press a button to deliver those shocks anytime that the student was incorrect. And then there was this authority figure with like a white, like scientist coat. And every time that the student made a mistake, the scientist would tell the teacher, you have to press a button to create a shock. And so they would press the button, and at the beginning, the shock was very low. It's just a few voltages, like maybe 25. And then it became large, bigger and bigger, bigger. And as the voltage went up and up and up and up, the student started screaming, you know. Now, the student wasn't real. It was a Confederate. But, you know, the bottom line from that study is that they showed that indeed people just followed the rules and they followed the instructions. But for us, what's interesting about the study is they didn't ask the teacher to deliver at 400 voltage shock in the beginning. They started off by 25 voltage. And then they went up to 30 and 35 and 70 and 90 and 100, slowly, slowly, slowly. And the student didn't scream from the beginning. At the beginning, maybe they were twitching a little bit, you know, and then slowly, slowly, slowly went to this really kind of strong reaction. And we think that if it wasn't for that, if it wasn't this gradual, gradual, gradual increase of the amount of shock that you administered, the amount of pain that you administered, and the amount of pain that you could hear the other person, probably the experiment would have not worked, quote unquote. It is this graduality of things that make things that seem quite terrible happen in life.
Yeah, so it's the fact that it each step is so small it doesn't seem like a change, that it seems like what you did yesterday, you're habituated to it, you're used to it, whereas
and your emotional response just goes down, right? I mean, and that's fundamental. The emotional habituation is something like your neighbor gets a new dog. You walk by and the dog is sparking, you know, you can see the teeth and you're like, ooh, you're really scared and you have a strong reaction. The next day they bark at you and you have less of a reaction. And the third day they bark at, by the fourth day, you're not even noticing, right? That's emotional habituation. And this has been shown in controlled experiments. So for example, showing people these really scary images of like, you know, scary dogs or whatever, again and again and again. At the beginning, you get a strong reaction, emotional reaction. You can see it, for example, looking at amygdala activity in the brain. The second time, the amygdala activity goes down. The third time goes down. And after a few times, there's no reaction at all. So it's emotional habituation.
Yes. In a way, you can see the sense of that, that you're... It means that rather than always noticing the things which are always there, you're on the lookout for something that's novel, that's surprising, that might be dangerous. You know, if as a caveman you stepped outside of your cave each day and spent all the time marveling at how green the grass was and how that lovely tree that you always see is so lovely, you'd probably get eaten by a lion. Whereas the other fellow who isn't noticing any of that, but is sort of attuned to something that's unusual, sees this great big orange lump that wasn't there yesterday and goes, my God, that's a lion. So you can see the sense of it.
Absolutely. It's adaptive. And the important thing is that if the dog would have jumped out and bit you in the neck, then you wouldn't habituate, right? So if there is an actual negative outcome that is clear and happening to you, then you kind of develop this reaction, right? It's because you're afraid, but then nothing happens. There's no outcome. There's no negative outcome, no punishment to you. And so that's why you're allowed to habituate. Allowed being the brain allows you to do that.
Okay, I can see how it's used then by people who want to move public opinion. Because the lesson that you just taught us, if you want to move public opinion, especially if you want them to move a long way into something they wouldn't accept, just do it in small steps. Mm-hmm. Don't come out on day one saying, you know that group of people over there? We should shoot them. Because everyone will go, whoa, that's terrible. So you've just been very small increments. You just gradually move people to something that if it was done in one step, they'd find it unacceptable. But providing you break it down, and each time it seems unimportant, just a little extra, then that's how you do it.
Yeah, I hope this is not a lesson of how to, how to create.
I don't suppose the tyrants of the world are taking notes, going, "I didn't think of that."
yeah, but it's important to understand because you know then maybe we can be more on alert, and find ways to kind of protect ourselves from that. And, you know, in our own life, it could be smaller things, right?
Well, there was a lovely thing that you mentioned, but you didn't go into a lot when you were talking about social media. And then you said that, I can't remember if it was you or your colleague, or I think it was you, actually. You said you created a sort of a mock social media thing, but you added two buttons. So instead of just being the like button, you added, what was it, trust and distrust. Tell us about that, because I thought it was a lovely idea. I felt like writing immediately to Facebook saying, excuse me, we should have two extra buttons.
Right. I mean, there's an obvious problem on social media, which is we are incentivized to share information than then is shared more, right? So you share information and you get likes and you get retweets and that's what you want. But these kind of like carrots that we get in terms of like more retweets, more likes is not tightly associated with how accurate the information is. Studies show that in fact, misinformation is likely to be shared even if the same or even more than accurate information. So there isn't an incentive on social media to share correct information. There isn't incentive to not share fake information. And so we, in order to try to kind of change that, we did a little experiment where we added two buttons, trust and distrust. The reason we added trust and distrust is trust, by definition, is the belief in the veracity of information, mm-hmm. right? And what we found is the following. First of all, we found that people did use trust and distrust to dissociate correct true information and false information. So they're more likely to press trust for true information and more likely to press distrust for false information. Of course, not everyone knows what's true and false. It's just on average, they used it, and they used it to discern much more than, for example, like. We also added a dislike button. So liking, because why is that? Like, it has nothing to do with accuracy. I can like something that you say that I know is not true, and that's fine. I still like it. That's okay, right? So like and dislike, people don't use it as much to discern true from false, and trust and distrust, they do. That's the first thing that we found. The second thing that we found is that now that people were in this new environment where they could get carrots in the form of trust buttons and they could get sticks in the form of distrust buttons if they put something wrong on, they started posting more true information and less false information, right? In order to get these carrots and avoid the sticks. And finally, what we found is that at the end of the day, they ended up with more correct beliefs. because being in this environment where people could, you could see the trust and distrust from other people, you thought more carefully about what you are about to share, people ended up with more true beliefs. And they didn't engage less, right? I mean, social media platforms are usually really concerned with the level of engagement. They did not engage less. So there really isn't any reason for the platforms not to try this. Now, we did this, we kind of like, we simulated an environment. It's not the exact environment that you see on Twitter and Facebook because we're not allowed access to that. But it's worth at least trying out.
Yeah, you know, yeah, yeah. See, I thought it was a great idea as soon as I saw it.
Yeah.
Can I throw a couple of quick questions at you from people who are listening? An anonymous attendee says, if habituation leads to a less creative, maybe less fulfilling life, how do I force myself to notice it? What routines can I build into my daily life to avoid it? How do you avoid it?
Yeah, so there are two answers which are related to each other. The first is to break up the good experiences. So let me tell you about this experiment. So imagine or think about a song that you really like, and I'm going to ask you, would you rather listen to the song from beginning to end, no interruptions, or would you rather have little breaks in the song? When you ask this question, almost everyone, 99% of the people say, I want to listen beginning to end. I don't want an interruption, right? But when the experiment was done, they actually found that people enjoyed a song more if they had breaks. Very counterintuitive, right? Why? If you have a song that you really like, at the beginning you enjoy it a lot, but then the joy kind of goes down a little bit. You still enjoy it, but the joy goes down over time, habituation. But if I break it and there's an interruption and then the song starts again, your joy goes back up. And so overall, people enjoyed the song more with breaks. Same thing with massages. They did the same thing. People thought, oh, I want the massage beginning to end. I don't want a break. But in fact, people enjoy the massage more with breaks. So one idea is you want to break up good experiences into bits. For example, think about vacations. I did a study for a big tourism company in the UK, TUI actually, where they wanted to know when are people happiest on vacation and what makes them happy. And what we found was that people were happiest 43 hours into a vacation. 43 hours gave them the time to kind of settle in and focus on fun. And from that point on, joy started going down and down and down. They were still happy on day 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. They were still happy, but not as happy as day 2 because of habituation. And when we asked them, hey, what was the best part of the vacation? The word that they use more than any other word is first. The first view of the ocean, the first sandcastle I did, the first cocktail. The second view of the ocean was quite good. The second cocktail, the third cocktail, the fifth cocktail was quite good. But it wasn't as good as the first, because first is new and exciting, right? And so kind of to think about that, what you want is to create more firsts, right? To create more 43 hours in. And so one way to do it is perhaps, you know, if possible, to take shorter vacations and more of them rather than just one long one. So break up experience, even if you're in your own life. We all have some good stuff in our life. Perhaps it's, you know, a comfortable home, an interesting job or a loving relationship. But because they're always there all the time, we don't notice them as much. It doesn't bring us as joy. And one thing you could do is just take a little break from your life, if possible, right? Go away for a while. So people often feel if they go away for like business for a few days and then they come back, they're able to see their life in kind of new eyes, right? A lot of things suddenly seem like, oh, this is so wonderful. It doesn't last for long, but at least for that short amount of time, things kind of like, we call it re-sparkle. It's a word actually we adopted from Julia Roberts, where she talks about how her daily life is quite mundane. She wakes up, she takes the kids to school, she comes back, maybe she has lunch with her husband, she goes on her bicycle and then makes dinner. And she says, well, if I had just did that every day for the rest of my life, it would be probably really boring, but I go away. And I come back. And every time I come back, there's like pixie dust over it, right? So it's not, of course, Julia Roberts has like a very unusual, uncommon existence. But I think what she's talking about here is something that is very humane, is very true, that we need to kind of break away for a tiny little bit. And then we come back and then we're able to see things. So breaking up good experiences. The other common way is changing our life, diversity, right? Trying new things, maybe like working on different projects, hobbies, taking a class, talking to new people, to diverse people, by creating change and diversity and variety, we will dishabituate again and again and again. And we will put ourselves in a situation of learning, because a new environment, you need to learn. What are the rules, right? What are the hierarchy? And when you put yourself in a sense of learning, that actually creates a huge amount of joy. People have a lot of joy from learning. I mean, people here probably know it because they're in the How To Academy to learn, right? So these kind of things, actually, studies have shown, bring people much more joy than material things, than just more money or another thing, right? Because learning by definition is change, and you cannot habituate to change. But you can habituate to material stuff. You buy a new car, it's great. But over time, you kind of habituate to it.
That's great. And that's a really positive note to end on, because I'm afraid we've run long because, well, what you're saying was really interesting, so we weren't going to stop. But we have run out of time. So Tali, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for everyone.
This episode starred Tali Sharratt and was produced by Georgia Attlesey. I make the show with Nicole Wong, and our editor is John Doughty. Until next time, I'm Vass Christodoulou. Thanks for listening.